This program was brought to you by Eat On North. Eat On North is a casual restaurant where honest, uncomplicated food is served without pretension. Find Eat On North at hotelonnorth.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
If I say Kraft, Cracker Jacks, Quaker Oats, Cheerios, Oscar Mayer, are you getting any connection? Maybe if I say Vienna beef, deep dish pizza. Okay, now there's a little twinkle of recognition. You got it. We're talking Chicago today on A Taste of the Past. Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And yes, indeed, today we are talking about Chicago, my kind of town. And it's Chicago, a food biography. If you really didn't know about Chicago and its food, this is the place to find out. It's a new book, recently new book, by two authors who are destined to become the new Ben and Jerry's, or dare I say, the Oscar and Meyer. Dan Block and Howard Rosing. Dan is a professor of geography and director of the Fred Bloom Neighborhood Assistance Center at Chicago State University. And Howard is executive director of the Stern Center for Community-Based Service Learning and Community Service Studies at DePaul University, as well as the co-director of DePaul's graduate program in Sustainable Urban Development. Welcome, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Okay. And I'll talk to you one at a time. We've got you both on the phone, and I'm so glad that you could take some time out from your work to join me this morning. Chicago, it's part of a, let me just tell our listeners that the book is part of a series from Roman Littlefield Publishers called about big city food. It's the Big City Food Biography Series, and it's edited by our friend Ken Albala, who is no stranger to this show. And these books are terrific. They tell the history of cities through the lens of food. And now first, Dan, I'm going to ask you, are you a Chicago native?
Yeah, I was born at the University of Chicago. My parents were grad students at the time. And I grew up, I think we moved when I was 5 to Evanston, which is the first suburb north of the city.
Well, that's still Chicago. That's okay.
Yeah, pretty much Chicago.
Right. And Howard, how about you?
Similar kind of trajectory. My family's all from Chicago, from the South Side, from South Shore, and I grew up mostly just a few miles from Danny in Skokie, and now live in Evanston. So,
well, that's terrific. So you both know what you're talking about. What I like about this book is that it really covers food and the history of Chicago, but not necessarily just the culture, the food culture and economics, as you even say in the book, that it's a story, yes, of culture, economics, and innovation, but also what I found really interesting, because I've talked about this on other shows, is the history of regulation and the regulators and how all of these things played together to really shape Chicago in not only as it the, you know, impinging upon the foodways of Chicago, but turning it into a real food city. We're going to get to that, but first I want to kind of talk about, and this I guess would be directed at you, Dan, the geographic location and how did that really affect Chicago's foodways?
Well, intensely, I would say. So, first of all, Chicago, pre-European settlement, and this is an area that Howard probably a little more about than me, but it was a place that people passed through. It really wasn't because it was mainly swamps, really wasn't a place with a whole lot of sort of agriculture right in town. And then, It was sort of the main city at the center of the country, the place where this kind of bounty of the West and the South and other places, any place where the Mississippi River and Illinois River and then the canal that led to Chicago and the railroads that led to Chicago, any place where any of those raw ingredients were coming from, all that, you know, flowed into Chicago and got processed and priced and shipped off to the East Coast and to Europe and other places. So it's, you know, its location in the center of the United States absolutely shaped it's the importance of food to its history and its foodways as well.
Oh, I see. And a lot of people probably have absolutely no idea that Chicago was one large swamp. And I found the digging of the canal that connected Chicago to the rivers really interesting, because I, having grown up near there, never knew that either. And that was quite interesting. Howard, so you would be, I know you talk in the book about the pre-du sable or sable times, and who was this, and how, what is the meaning of that when you say in terms of the geography and the history, the pre-du sable times?
Well, essentially what you have is a Chicago with a variety of people who inhabited the area for sometimes very short periods of time and sometimes very long periods of time, depending on the time period. And you have initially Paleo-Indian population that literally comes down from the north as the glacier is receding and starts to inhabit northeastern Illinois, northern Illinois, southern Wisconsin. And these are pretty much people who are living off what the land is producing in terms of animal life and rivers and fishing and various kinds of hunting and gathering activities. But in time, over thousands of years, you have transitions of various types that I'm going to really shortcut into saying that there are periods of time where there are certain kinds of foods that become predominant. For example, there's quite a bit of nut processing that goes on in the area of acorns and various other kinds of nuts. There's eventually lots of seeds that are produced, many of which are still grown in plants that are viewed as weeds today in Chicago, that people were eating and actually at some point domesticating, more so even than corn, which arrived much later. So you have a series of different populations coming through, and archaeological evidence really that's cited in the book and sort of put together around this basic theme of transitions until we get to the point of European contact, where you have people who are slowly but surely integrating corn and beans into their diet along with local animal consumption of various types, and principally white-tailed deer, for which still are prevalent in Chicago today, but were actually reintroduced after they pretty much were just extinguished by the 1950s.
Mm. Interesting. And what I find interesting is during that time, we all know that immigration played a tremendous role and still does in many of the food cultures in the great cities. But aside, and you say the introduction of European contact then brought different changes too. But I think what's unique to me, and you answer one, either of you, about the location of Chicago as a location, was the early mixing of the races before the European contact, probably more so than any other city we have in the United States. Who's going to address it? Howard? Doug? Dan?
I wouldn't say, it was before the there had been European contact, but it was a mix of, du sable himself was from Haiti, and we think probably probably some a mixed race person from Haiti and perhaps Canada as well. There was a group of people called the Métis, which were generally of mixed French and Native American descent. And then there was, the traders who came in who were French, and then once Ormeti, and then once this was part of the United States, they were, some of them were from English descent or other European descent, and then Fort Dearborn opened, and Fort Dearborn was, you know, had generally Americans from the East Coast, and so you had you know, this mixing at places like it's actually sort of a famous picture or scene in Chicago history. So you had places like the Saguenay Hotel, which was owned by a guy named Mark Bovian, who is, his family was originally from Detroit. He was a Métis trader himself. But, you know, he played the fiddle, and there's these images of the daughters from the daughters of the Métis dancing with the some of the men from the from Fort Dearborn. So, you know, it's kind of this mixing of all these different groups for really only a few years. We're talking, you know, from around the late 1820s until the about 1834, when the Treaty of Chicago was signed, and the Native Americans were pretty much kicked out. Mm. And at that point, really, the true growth of Chicago as a town, and then quickly as a city, began.
Yeah. You know, I think what a lot of people don't understand so much about Chicago, or maybe they do, is that it was not, you had mentioned it, or someone of you had mentioned it at the top of the show when we talked, that it, even though it was sort of in this agricultural area, it really is not, never became like a, let's say, a breadbasket, but more of a wholesale food center, and to this day still continues. I mean, of course, we talk about, you know, meats, the meatpacking area and the stockyards. And if anyone remembers way back when, there was, you know, that was a place to get an incredible steak. Go to the Stockyard Inn and have an incredible steak right off the off the stockyards. But tell us a little bit about, and then of course the Mercantile Exchange, you know, became very big and popular. So tell us a little bit about that development of the whole wholesale from a food, you know, center to a, you know, from a food market, let's say. Haymarket was huge, right? Talk a little bit about that, about the development of the city in terms of the markets.
So the wholesale market really was kind of key to the development of the city as a whole, and really to the development of the American food system as a whole. So originally food came in generally over the canal, and people would take their wares and sell maybe samples of them along the river. And that's why the original wholesale market started up at what was called South Water Market, which was on the warehouses that line the main branch of the Chicago River. So what would be right now what we call Wacker Drive. And that was the port of Chicago, which was extremely busy in the, let's say, 1860s, the largest freshwater port in the world. And so there were wholesale markets there, but not just for, say, feeding Chicago, but for there were warehouses that sold to the, you know, the entire Midwest and beyond. So again, as Chicago became this railroad center, there was, you know, there were produce as well as commodities coming in from, you know, all over the South and the West. Say this South meaning there, you know, Texas, Mississippi, and then all of the West and as far west as California, coming into Chicago being processed, being repackaged, being and then being sold to groceries and manufacturers in Chicago and throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And so South Water Markets, eventually it wasn't on the train lines because it was originally sited because of where the canal, where the sort of water was, with the canal leading to the river. It became much, much too crowded, so they built a new South Water Market. Still called it South Water Market. It was nowhere near the water, but it was along the railroads. And Howard actually grew up. His dad actually worked there. So I don't know, Howard, do you want to say a little about the new South Water Market?
Actually, my grandfather was a produce broker at South Water Market and ran for decades, ran a produce company there, buying and selling onions and potatoes predominantly. I would say, just to add to what Danny was saying, that Chicago really it took off from the beginning. Just a year after the city was chartered, they were already shipping bushels of wheat to Buffalo East by steamship, and to give you the extent of it, there a little over 3,600 bushels sent in 1839. And in 4 years later, there was over 628,000 bushels sent. And then by mid-century, there were more than 2 million bushels of wheat and corn, going out of Chicago. And Chicago emerges as this huge grain collector, right, the stacker of wheat and corn. And that precedes really the meat packing industry, which eventually becomes, Chicago's almost namesake, right?
Mm-hmm.
And with that comes the railroads, which became extremely important. And really the railroads were driven by the meat industry largely. And so, producing railroads to ship meat east. And so you have this produce market building alongside that as well, as you see all this production coming from, as Danny mentioned, the west and the south, up the rivers and eventually the trains. So it becomes, carloads and then eventually truckloads of produce, and eventually all that becoming, making Chicago really a world market for food.
Wow. And obviously this coincided with the tremendous rapid growth of the city as well during that period, right? What we are going to do, I want to talk a little bit about any specialty items that actually were grown and from Chicago. You mentioned very briefly, and it was also in an article about the book, about the Lakeview area becoming the celery center of Chicago. A little point I have to make about that when we come back after a brief break, because we're going to fast forward to some modern day foods, or not so modern, that people will recognize. So stay tuned when we come back.
Hi, I'm Brian Alberg, and I'm the executive chef at Eat On North in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts. Eat On North in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts is a casual restaurant where good, honest, uncomplicated food is served to our guests. Our restaurant is part of the hotel called Hotel On North, the newly opened boutique hotel in downtown Pittsfield. We source local ingredients from our neighboring farms and offer an all-day dining menu of flavorful American cuisine for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and on weekends we serve brunch. Our oyster bar serves up delicious shellfish and oyster samplers until 11 p.m. Check out our menu at eatonnorth.com and follow us on Instagram. Thank you.
Hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past, and we're talking about Chicago and Chicago's foodways and the history of Chicago through the lens of food with Dan Block and Howard Rosing, who've written a terrific compendium of facts and interesting factoids called Chicago, A Food Biography. And I brought up the celery part of it, either of you. Only because that was something that was brought up in a newspaper article. The Tribune wrote something about it. But something that is, to me, really special about Chicago and the hot dogs. You can't go to Chicago without having a hot dog, right? What people from perhaps the West or the East Coast would not understand is that if you are a true native and like your hot dog Chicago style, what are you going to have on top, aside from a bunch of vegetables, which is unusual, but celery salt? Now, is this something that's still, and that's why, Dan, I remember reading, you said something about, in the article, about you standing in line for the closing of Hot Dogs. That's another thing people got to know. Hot Dogs, and not dog, but Dogs, because he owned it. But that's why I keep calling you Doug instead of Dan, because you stood in line to get that last hot dog from Hot Dogs before they closed. Is celery salt still a thing that you find a lot in the hot dog stores?
It is an essential ingredient of a Chicago hot dog. I think it sort of comes out of the fact that there is kind of a salad on top. It sort of adds and the word I'm thinking of is piquantness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah, word, you're right. Yeah, absolutely.
kind of a smack, to it that I think really goes well with the combination of mustard and onions and tomatoes and pickle and sport peppers that are also on the dog. So
yeah, highly recommended.
I think as well, all of that combination points out and Bruce Craig, who's written on hot dogs, has got into this a lot more than we did, but points out how just in that hot dog you can see the sort of mix of cultures that makes up Chicago food. The kosher beef hot dog, the vegetables themselves, like the peppers when we come from the South, idea of a combination of vegetables is probably an Italian or a Greek thing. So, it's really a great cultural mix in itself, just that Chicago hot dog.
Yeah. Well, so many big food companies started to develop, I guess, you tell me about the advent of the the railroad and the shipping and being the wholesale market. But talk about some of the big names that listeners would recognize that were, I mentioned at the top of the show, a couple. But some of the big name companies, I said Kraft. I don't know if people remember Swift or Armour, but talk about a couple of those companies that developed. Doug, Dan. I got to get rid
Howard,
of Doug.
That was Howard's chapter.
Howard. That was Howard. Howard's chapter. Okay, Howard.
Well, I mean, certainly you have all the major meat companies and all the major hot dog companies coming out of Chicago, especially Vienna, which if you drive around Chicago just anywhere, you can't get away from seeing a Vienna, hot dog sign. And so we see, like, Chicago really emerging as this place where you have these major manufacturers like Quaker Oats and others who become sort of a icon of Western large scale production of food commodities for consumption, for household consumption, right? And really, just about every major company had a stake in Chicago at some time, even if they didn't originate here. And one of the factors there was, of course, the meat industry, but also grains and access to just the bulking of different kinds of foods in Chicago, and the ease really of people settling here from a variety of different parts of the world. Immigrants really drove, driven by sort of these large scale manufacturing sites for food predominantly. You have, you know, bread companies, you have the major bread companies, you have major companies like Argo, which produces starch.
Cornstarch, the famous cornstarch, right.
You have companies like Morton Salt, right, and, you know, founded in Chicago predominantly because Chicago was salting meat, which was fed to Civil War soldiers seeking to, you know, win the war for the North. So you have Chicago really is this major hub for these companies, largely coming out of late 19th century, early 20th century historical events.
Interesting, and the cereals too. You said a lot of grain, you know, access to the grain. So obviously there were a lot of cereal companies who were getting their start then too. And as I promised, we would fast forward to some of today's foods that people would expect to find, whether it's street food or in particular restaurants. And you mentioned, Howard, the Vienna beef, Vienna sausage, something that, well, does Dan describe a Vienna?
A Vienna beef sausage. So it's as compared to, say, Nathan's hot dog, it is slightly more heavily spiced. It's got a little more crunch to it the skin's a little crunchier. Holds up well to being sort of tasted within that whole, you know, salad that we like to put on it.
Right.
And it's beef, and I think, you know, it came out of they were first being served in Maxwell Street in the, you know, the Jewish area of Chicago, one of the many, but sort of the original sort of first generation immigrant Jewish area, as a street food. And now, you know, Vienna is a pretty large company, and the Chicago hot dog is sort of going somewhat. You know, you can get them in most big cities around the country, and the Vienna beef dog is sort of an important part of what people sell. I just was talking to, as I said, Bruce Craig, who's, among other things, a hot dog historian, who said that Vienna had just built a new processing plant on the southwest side. So we're doing well.
It's here to stay.
with our hot dogs.
That's great. That's great. Yeah. One thing I realized we didn't talk about, which you know, is candy and the sugar industry,
mm-hmm.
and that was a very important part of Chicago food history. Who's going to take that?
Well, I mean, this is probably one of my favorite parts of the book because, you know, you discover really almost all of the candy people enjoy today in this country and perhaps a good part of the world started in Chicago. I mean, before we talk about candy, we can talk about things like the Twinkie, right?
Oh, yeah.
Chicago-born, which some people might consider like candy, I suppose. but, you know, companies like Sara Lee got their start in Chicago, and you know, the sweet industry in general was very much a Chicago, starter place. In Chicago, really, you see, you know, sugar coming up the Mississippi River into the canal and coming in containers early on. And early in the mid-19th century, you have a candy industry, confectionery industry beginning, first built on sugarcane grown in the Caribbean by slaves. And so you have that emerging, and eventually you have the development of corn syrup in Chicago through Argo and investments by Joy Morton, the founder of Morton Salt. And you have eventually Chicago becoming a place where there's this production of a kind of sugar from corn and others, which goes into the candy industry. But the real catchers, of course, you have, you know, products that end up here, like developing here, like Cracker Jacks, and eventually all the major candy companies and large ones like Brock's and Fannie Mae, but also the ones that people sort of know when they walk into the corner store and buy, you know, whether it's Wrigley chewing gum, Baby Ruth, or Tootsie Rolls, or you know, any of these, O. Henry Milk Duds, etc., down to the Milky Way. And so it's really a place, Chicago, where candy Chicago becomes the candy capital at one point. It loses that status eventually, but it was known and thought of itself as a candy capital for a long time.
And that's interesting. Makes it a very sweet town. I know one thing that one of my favorites always, as I say, having grown up in the area, was not so much of the candy industry, but bought by a department store and made for a department store were the Frango mints. You mentioned Fannie Mae Chocos, and immediately I went to Frango's. Frango mints, and then I think it was an earlier department store before Marshall Field, Frederick and Nelson or somebody. But then Marshall Field's had the license, and it wouldn't be a holiday time if someone didn't have a box of Frango mints.
Yeah, well, and I remember, not all that long ago, when you'd go into Fields, there was a Frango factory upstairs.
Right, right.
It was, you could kind of, I don't know how I knew it was up there, but when you were up on the food floor, on the seventh floor, I think the Frango factory was either 8 or 9, and you could kind of tell.
Yeah. That's unusual that, the fact that, you know, they didn't grow the sugar there, but of course the railroads and the corn syrup, as you mentioned, are just really interesting that that's where all this candy would be developed. Now, of course, Chicago is known for its fine chefs and fine dining. It's always had a lot of fine dining, but now, of course, even more so, a lot of its innovative dining. Certain things have not left, and which is nice. I'm glad to see that. As you say, the Vienna's there to stay. Deep dish pizza. I mean, where did that come? Where did that come about? It's not even really like a Sicilian pizza. We'll call it here out east, a thick crust with some sauce on it. But deep dish is a whole thing unto itself.
So it really came as an idea of a Texan guy who moved up here during World War II. He had a partner turned out to be an Italian chef. And originally he wanted to start, it seemed like sort of a Tex-Mex kind of restaurant. But the chef decided, they should do Italian. He created Uno's Pizzeria, the first deep dish Chicago deep dish pizza, anyway. Like the Italian beef, like the hot dog, it was a large, something that filled you up for not all that expensive. But it caught on, and it created a pizza culture in Chicago that really is about the sit down pizza culture rather than pizza just being the street food that it is in New York and a lot of other places.
That's right. I mean, it's kind of hard to take a deep dish on the run.
Exactly. And we sit down, you wait for 45 minutes, you get a salad or something. And
right. Once you eat it, you're definitely not running.
Right. That's right.
After it ends, you can't run either.
Yeah, well, there are so many great things about Chicago's food culture that are to be found in your book, but also to be walking the streets and eating some of the food and the beer industry. That's another great thing too. That really was a major part of Chicago's food culture. right? The beer?
Yeah, I mean, early on, especially the German population brought with it lots of talented beer, and the German population was, you know, at one point the largest population in Chicago, and they brought with a beer culture, a beer production culture, a beer consumption culture, which at times the city government wasn't too excited about. Some of the largest beer gardens in the country were here in Chicago, if not the largest, all over predominantly the north side of the city. And you still find some remnants of beer gardens in Chicago's north side from that era. From mid-19th century, German beer manufacturing and consumption. The one thing that really hurt the beer industry badly was the Chicago Fire, which burnt down a number of the beer production
breweries.
Breweries, thank you.
You're welcome.
Burnt down a number of the breweries, and from that point on, Milwaukee took charge of the beer industry in the Midwest.
Huh, interesting. Well, not much has changed. Look, we've got all these new beer breweries and artisan beers cropping up all over the place. So what better with a hot dog or a Vienna than a big stein of beer? You don't have to go to Chicago for that, but I encourage you to. Or if not, just pick up the book and read Chicago, A Food Biography by Dan Block and Howard Rosen. Guys, thank you so much for joining me and sharing some very interesting tidbits. It really sheds a new light on Chicago as a food central. And I look forward to reading more of it. And thank you for listening on A Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.